This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Well, the Williams sisters are out of the French Open. The Lakers and the Pistons will meet in the NBA Finals. And could it be? Smarty Jones tries for the Triple Crown this weekend at Belmont Park in New York. To call us and ask questions about tennis, basketball, or horse racing, our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us an email, TOTN at NPR.org. As we mentioned, Americans are not faring well in Paris. A topsy-turvy French Open on the men's and women's side as Argentinians dominate. Serena and Venus Williams are forced out due to an extraordinary number of unforced errors. Meanwhile, back in the States, the Detroit Pistons are lined up to take on the Lakers this weekend as the NBA Championship Series gets underway. Joining us now is ESPN, the magazine, Steve Malley. He's with us on the phone from New York City, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
How are you, Neil? Great to be here.
Very well, thanks. Last night, Pacers failed to extend their Eastern Conference Series, and, they go on to meet the Lakers. The Pistons, go on to meet the Lakers in the NBA Finals.
It's going to be an interesting final. I've watched pretty much every game that's come along so far, and you watch a defensive team take on an offensive team, and who knows what's going to happen. The interesting note, the Detroit Pistons have averaged 75 points a game. The Lakers are averaging about 90 points a game. So is it a matter of the Pistons stopping the Lakers, or is it a matter of can the Pistons score enough points?
Well, some people are saying Lakers in three. They don't think it's much of a matchup.
You know, that's an interesting thing. We were kicking that around in the office today, and what the Pistons throw at the Lakers is a very solid inside game. They have six guys over 6'10", plus a perimeter offense that they didn't show much of against the Pacers. But, you know, the Pacers are a very, very powerful defensive team, too, so they shut down. I mean, they're a much stronger defensive team than the Lakers are. It's just that the Lakers have so many offensive weapons that you wonder how can you stop everything.
And they have one wonderful defensive player, also one of their wonderful offensive players, a guy by the name of Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, he's a pretty good player at both ends of the court, and what's been interesting throughout the series is which Kobe's going to show up and play. I mean, it seems like after he goes to Colorado and he comes back, he's hot, 30 points, 35 points, but then the next game he may stand around for the first half and supposedly trying to get his teammates engaged. But when Kobe turns it on, he turns it on like a few players we've seen.
He will be, I would suspect, guarding the one consistent offensive star on the Detroit Pistons, and that's Rip Hamilton.
You have to wonder, you know, do you put Kobe on their strongest offensive player, tire him out, perhaps get him in foul trouble? I mean, that's what Rip Hamilton can do. It's what he did to Reggie against the Pacers. And I'm not sure that, Phil Jackson may be playing a little bit of a game there and put somebody else on Rip and let Kobe run around for a while. If he has to guard Rip, I mean, as Rip said in the Pacers game, I'm the best conditioned player in the league, and I'm just trying to get Reggie tired. So if he does this, he could try the same thing against Kobe if Kobe's guarding him.
I'm talking about Reggie Miller, the rather older player of the Indiana Pacers, who was forced to guard him in the Eastern Conference Final Series. Detroit Pistons also have one of the more controversial players in recent years in the National Basketball Association, Rasheed Wallace, who's noted for making controversial remarks from time to time. Yet the Los Angeles Lakers, that club has been a soap opera all year long, and that's not to trivialize Kobe Bryant's rape trial that's coming up in Colorado.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to trivialize that, but you watch the Lakers throughout the season and you say, these guys have so much talent, so much potential. They've added Karl Malone and Gary Payton, yet they seem to be sleepwalking throughout the season, through the early part of the playoff. But, deep inside, you always knew that something could click, something could go off, and these guys are, again, going to be supposedly an unbeatable or seemingly an unbeatable, the best team in basketball kind of thing. And it seemed like it happened when Derek Fisher threw up that, as Shaq called it, one lucky shot deserves another in the San Antonio series that won the game, turned the team around. They seem to be having more fun. They seem to be more cohesive. They seem to be just playing great basketball both ends of the court, for 48 minutes.
Now let's turn to Roland Garros, the French Open, Paris in the springtime, an extraordinary French Open.
It's been an odd week and a half over in Roland Garros. It's, the top four seeds on the women's side are all gone. actually the top five women seeds. The top American left is Jennifer Capriati, who won here a couple of years ago. She's the only player left in the semis on the women's side who has a who has won a slam. And on the men's side, it's just as odd. I mean, we're down to three Argentinian players. And the Argentinian players, by the way, are doing incredibly, have an incredible season. I believe they have seven players in the top 50, and only Spain with eight in the top 50 have, you know, per country have more players. That's 15 players from two Spanish-speaking nations in the top 50 on the men's side. Three players, and then Tim Henman from England is the other semifinalist. So it's been a strange series. I mean, Roddick, the number one player in the world last year, is out early. Agassi lost to a qualifier in his first match, may not play in the French Open again at age 34. It's been a strange week and a half.
Let's get a caller involved. Frank joins us on the line from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, I'm a tennis fan, and I have a comment about the French Open or a concern. There's been a huge focus on the Americans, particularly in the TV coverage. That seems to me to be to the detriment in general of the fan because, for instance, yesterday, I think it was ESPN had coverage three times during the day. They showed the same match three times, all on tape, while all sorts of interesting tennis, several interesting stories were going on. You know, they showed Capriati and Williams three times.
Steve Malley works for ESPN, the magazine, but what about your television colleagues, Steve?
You're really putting me on the hot seat here. I think that, I can't speak for TV, but when I think what's happening is when they're looking at what stories most of the Americans are going to be interested in and want to see, they're saying, okay, Serena Williams, who's won something like five of the last eight slams versus, you know, another American, Jennifer Capriati, who's won three slams in her career and at 28 is on her way back. Is that the match that most people want to see? Well, probably. Although I agree with you that there are a number of interesting matches that we should be seeing, especially with that much coverage throughout the day. So I'm actually agreeing with Frank that there are other matches, but I'm in some way defending what, you know, the decision that the networks have to make in trying to put on, you know, a match that, you know, a lot of people want to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough call.
It's short-sighted because they're failing to market the very sport that they're showing because, Correa hasn't been on TV at all. Gustavo Kuerten, great story. Tim Henman, they just haven't covered it.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, and we actually featured Correa in the magazine in our preview to the French Open. So, of course, we'd like to see him on the television at least once. And you're right, we haven't seen him at all. And there are a lot of good matches. I agree. I mean, there are a lot of matches, and if we're going to market the sport going forward, we've got to bring some other names into the forefront because, you know, some of the names that we're used to seeing, we're not seeing them at the top this year, that's for sure.
Frank, thanks very much for the call.
You bet.
And Steve Malley, it's nice to be talking about tennis and not about one tennis player's decision to drop his shorts and show us his underpants there on the courts in Paris. Appreciate that. Steve Malley, an editor with ESPN, the magazine. Thanks for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Steve Malley joined us on the phone from his office in New York City. 3-year-old Smarty Jones became a household name last month when he ran through the slop to win the Kentucky Derby.
Smarty Jones on the outside, Lionheart at the rail, and down the stretch they come. Smarty Jones forging to the front. Lionheart is tough on the inside second. Middle of the racetrack, here comes Lion. Here comes Limehouse third. Imperialism is closing, but as they come to the wire, Smarty Jones with Stuart Elliott. They win it. God Service the trainer, and it is Smarty Jones the winner by two.
Some had doubts about Smarty Jones despite that victory in the Kentucky Derby. He erased many of those doubts with a convincing victory in the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore. This Saturday, he has a chance to win the Belmont Stakes and become the first horse to win the Triple Crown since 1978. Joining us now to talk about Smarty Jones is Andy Beyer, horse columnist for the Washington Post and author of, among other books, Beyer on Speed. Andy, always good to have you on Talk of the
Nation. Hi, Neil.
Not since Affirmed has a horse won the Triple Crown. Why is this so difficult?
Well, obviously the races themselves are challenging, but in recent years I think that there simply hasn't been a horse good enough to do it. The in the last few years, we've seen horses like Funny Side and War Emblem and Real Quiet in the position that Smarty Jones is now, and they all failed. But when you look back on them, they weren't Triple Crown horses. They did not deserve to have their names on a short list with Affirmed and Seattle Slew and Secretariat. I think that that Smarty Jones is a different type of horse.
We're talking with Andy Beyer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Andy, you wrote an interesting article this past week in the Washington Post talking about how the emergence of Smarty Jones puts the lie to a lot of deeply held beliefs about the breeding of classic stakes horses.
Well, it contradicts about several centuries of evidence about horse breeding. I mean, for most of the history of this species, breeders have tried to create a champion with the proper blend of speed and stamina. And in recent years, I mean, the American breeding industry has gotten more and more speed oriented. And Smarty Jones epitomizes that tendency. I mean, you look at both of his parents, and you can't see any evidence that this horse was going to go a mile and a quarter in the Kentucky Derby. I mean, his daddy, Elusive Quality, ran his best race on the dirt at 7 furlongs. His mother was like a sprinter to a miler, but just that speed and raw ability was enough to get him the mile and a quarter distance. I still think the pedigree, could be a question at a mile and a half on Saturday.
Let's get a caller on the line. David is with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, sir.
You're on the air.
Yes, my question is, as compared to some of the favorites we've had in other races, Silver Image, Eddington, I think there's a couple other ones that were being mentioned around. How does this horse, Smarty Jones, compare in capacity for endurance and in breadth and height?
Andy?
I think the relevant question is endurance, and as I just said, in terms of his pedigree, he is much less imposing than say a horse like Rock Hard 10, who might be
heard of him.
His major rival on Saturday, but
Rock Hard 10 seemed to have needed the Preakness almost as a prep race.
He's classically bred. I mean, everybody who knows how to look at horses is always dazzled by his appearance, but I guess the proof is in the pudding and how fast they run. And Smarty Jones is clearly a lot better than this.
Are we possibly expecting a record time at the same caller from Lawrence, Kansas?
No, nobody's going to beat Secretariat's record.
You have to admit, Smarty Jones did draw comparisons to the great Secretariat with that impressive victory in Baltimore, though.
The race in the Preakness, I thought, verified that this horse really is exceptional. I am a student of speed. I've been computing speed figures for decades, and since our speed figures have been published in the Daily Racing Form over the last 12 years, he equaled like the best performance by any horse in the Triple Crown race. So he's really a member of the elite.
Andy Beyer, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Neil.
Andy Beyer, horse racing columnist for the Washington Post, with us by phone from his home here in Washington. An email to read before we go. This from Madison Lee, and a Buffalo Sabres fan. He writes, okay, NBA Finals, tennis, and horse racing, all exciting. Ridiculous, though, not to mention the fact that the Tampa Bay Lightning and Calgary Flames are tied 2-2 in the series for the Stanley Cup. How can this get skipped over? It's been many years since a Canadian team has won the Cup. They're a clear underdog to one of the highest-paid teams from Florida, no less, that has no hockey tradition. It's a classic battle of old school versus new school, tradition versus money. Well, thus far, the first team that gets to one wins in the Stanley Cup Finals. We'll see if that continues when the series resumes in Tampa Bay. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is NPR News.